And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we are bleary-eyed and perhaps a little bored after sitting through the primetime Emmys, so we'll talk about how that went. We'll delve into the world of the one-hit wonder, which should result in quite a few moments in which you say, "Oh, right, that." And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies and pop culture and theater and that sort of thing, and I dance the happy dance because we're back in historic Studio 44.
We are. And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And we watched the Emmys last night. Uh-huh. It is currently Monday as we are taping. The Emmys were Sunday.
Jesus, they went on forever.
Yes, they sort of did go on forever. The host of the Emmys, as the host of everything now, according to law, was Neil Patrick Harris, who earlier this year did, in my opinion at the Tonys, the best award show opening, certainly of my lifetime. And last night on the Emmys, I would say, did not do
this was
the
not,
second best award show opening of my lifetime.
Swear to God. As you all know, I had to catch up with this on DVD today because I was watching Shakespeare last night instead of the Emmys. And Stephen very kindly recorded it and brought it in so I could watch it. And I watched the first 45 seconds of that montage.
That's all you watched?
That's all I watched. So I'm basing all of it. No. But boy, I was... And obviously there had been a lot of social media traffic and I heard from you guys that it wasn't great, but it just was terrible from the beginning.
Yeah, and it opens with Neil Patrick Harris going in. First of all, there's a joke about the fact that the security guard who lets him in is Les Moonves, who you only think that's funny if you know who Les Moonves
right.
is,
right.
which a lot of people don't.
I knew happened, it was a thing. I didn't know what the thing was.
Les Moonves, who's the president and an honcho of CBS and an unbelievably powerful guy in television, plays the security guard who lets Neil Patrick Harris into this booth where he's then surrounded by a ton of monitors that are playing little isolated clips from different shows that he's supposedly having a conversation with about his hosting, which it's just there's nothing fresh about it. There's nothing inventive about it.
I think we're burying the lead here, which is just that the tone of the setting aside the first few minutes, and sometimes the first few minutes of awards shows are disjointed.
Right.
They're finding their footing. I definitely felt like the first bunch of minutes of the show were off, up through the part where Neil Patrick Harris is kind of doing his opening monologue, and then they're bringing on past Emmy hosts. All that felt very stilted. To me, the bigger issue the whole way through was tone.
Yeah.
The tone of the whole telecast from start to finish was off.
Well, let me speak to that because, you know, you mentioned that you can't judge the whole thing just by the opening minutes, but there was something very cool and detached and that didn't ever rise to the level of irony in his presentation. And, you know, you can't put all of this on his shoulders, but there is something about the pace of that opening and the fact that it's like I'm going to accuse him of something I've never accused him before of, which is he didn't commit. It seems like he was holding back.
Yeah.
Now, part of that is because he had a thing to do in the middle that was a bigger thing, but there was something about that tone that gave it this very cool, not cool as in, you know, yay! We both referenced Fonzie.
Yes. What does that say about so many things?
All of the young listeners just ran screaming.
But emotionally chilly in a way that I don't associate with him.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Well, one of the other things about him, you know, I read a piece in TV Guide today where they interviewed the executive producer of the show. And they talked about the fact that he did not do an opening musical number, and opening musical numbers are often so popular. And the producer said, well, that was something that we got out of the way very early. When he agreed to host the show, one of the things he said was, I don't want to do an opening musical number because I don't want to compete with myself hosting the Tonys. Mm-hmm. And the producer was like, oh, no. And we said, no, we don't want you to compete with yourself hosting the Tonys. It didn't help.
Yeah.
People still watch this lame, kind of lifeless opening, and it set this tone of lameness that really persisted. Even though it's not like doing a bad musical number, even if you did one, is any worse in terms of comparing you than doing a bad regular skit.
The thing you did didn't work.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could feel the room pick up when Tina Fey and Amy Poehler showed up.
You could feel my room pick up.
Right?
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's not just a matter of that the tone of the whole show was off or lame or whatever. It was also, they made this very strange decision to like the show was just was a balloon, and then they would just let the air out of the balloon to talk about a beloved dead person. And I realized, I felt after a while, especially after the interminable In Memoriam segment that was on top of all of these
five segments
talking about wonderful people who had died. By staggering it out, they just kept, it was like they were portioning out sadness. They decided, like, we need to remind you that people die.
Because what your average 3-hour long broadcast variety show / self-congratulatory schmooze fest needs is more mourning.
Right. To be more funereal.
Give it this much, that it was interesting to have somebody speak about a dead person. It was not interesting not to show any clips of that person.
Right.
But to speak about it, and then when the applause comes at the end, it doesn't feel gross, because what's actually, it's a bit of jujitsu. What they're actually applauding in the audience is the person for doing a nice little speech.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels like you're taking some of that grossness away, but then they kind of undo that by having the In Memoriam, which is nothing but a gross fest.
Which has the, here's a person nobody's heard of.
Publicist.
And here's a publicist. And here's a famous person. You know, which is so tacky, and which everybody who criticizes awards shows has said a million times over is tacky. Many awards shows have figured out a way around it.
Mm-hmm.
You have the one piece of cello music that exists playing over the montage of people's.
It's the Bach cello variations.
Right. No, I know. But
I can guarantee that I found the show more enjoyable than either of you two, Linda and Stephen, did, because as soon as Dame Elton came out, I took that as a cue to switch over to Breaking Bad for more than an hour. I mean, the actual episode is longer than an hour of Breaking Bad. Much more life-affirming. And then when I came back...
much more cheerful.
When I came back, I could fast-forward through things like Elton John.
The Elton John Liberace thing was so strange to me, because as they set that up, I was thinking, are they really just going to have Michael Douglas say, and speaking of gay piano players, ladies and gentlemen, like, that really was kind of all there was to it. The other thing was, and I have to credit Dave Holmes, who I had an exchange with him on Twitter about the fact that there was also this really weird way they talked about Liberace being gay, that they kind of didn't talk about it.
Like, the word.
They were sort of saying, like, his life and how he lived.
His
and
lifestyle.
Elton John
was like,
John actually said lifestyle, which, I'm sorry, is it 92 again?
Well, no, but that was, he was sort of trying to square the circle a little bit. He was trying to go past being ironic about saying the word lifestyle, but it just kind of petered out.
It was a very, to me, it was a very odd little thing, and I didn't, when you combine it with the fact that when Michael Douglas won for that performance in Behind the Candelabra, he got up there and started making kind of those bro-y gay sex jokes with Matt Damon.
This was a two-hander. And Matt, you're only as good. You're only as good as your other hand. So I can't tell you, you were magnificent. And the only reason I'm standing here is because of you. So you really deserve half of this. So do you want the bottom or the top? So,
and I was kind of like, this whole point of this movie was really to emphasize that although this was a very troubled man, he was a very loving man in his way.
In
and
his
it
way.
Was kind of bent around various psychological issues that he had, but it was very humanizing about him and his lover, and I felt like for them to take that as an opportunity to do bottom jokes, I kind of thought that just seems so unbelievably tacky to me. I guess if it didn't feel so much to me like, how about the fact that we actually played gay guys?
Look what we got away with.
It was so distasteful to me.
I am going to say something that I never thought I would have to say about an award ceremony, which is enough with the gay.
Yeah.
Well, you even gotten to the choreography.
Well, see.
Right.
And the thing was, I would have been less bothered by the unnecessary Elton John performance, which only exists because he has an album coming out, and the unnecessary Carrie Underwood performance.
And if you cut those out, you end at 3 hours.
And, well, or you allow a little more air for speeches, which, I mean, I don't normally keep track of the time, so I can't swear whether this is true, but I felt like people were being played off extremely quickly. And I noticed this morning, Michael Douglas, who spent that first whole stretch making two different sort of sets of gay jokes, mm-hmm. right? Got to talk for a minute and a half
yeah.
before the orchestra started trying to tweedle him off.
And Claire Danes.
Claire Danes, who got up and the first thing she said was about this writer from Homeland who passed away earlier this year and won an Emmy, which his wife accepted.
Henry.
And she talks about that. And 45 seconds into her speech, which is basically when she's just gotten through this comment about we love writers and we are thinking of Henry and all that stuff, before she gets to say anything else, they start trying to play her off, and it's 45 seconds, despite the fact that she's in and out every week on this show and is one of the greatest actresses working on television. And it's nothing against what Michael Douglas did, but I wouldn't give him twice as much time to get up there and make har-har jokes with Matt Damon before he kind of gets underway and finally starts.
Right.
And I don't know who makes those decisions. I don't know what all the factors are, but the effect was that it felt to me like not only were people getting cut off really early, but some people were sort of more equal than others.
Yeah, well... I've found a lot lately that there are certain awards shows, and I think badly directed, badly run awards shows, that completely forget why they're there. The combination of cutting off the speeches and almost never in the course of 3 hours and 10 minutes ever showing any footage of anyone acting.
Yeah.
It's the ACTI Awards with no acting.
They're saving it all for
it would be like if the Grammys just did nothing but like solemn discussions of music and you know,
because it's not like the
Tonys. And they would have guest appearances by Hollywood stars in movie clips because that's not what they're doing. And it's right. You know, that's how we're going to make it special.
That's true. Because they certainly had musical performances.
Because it's not like the Tonys, where the specialness of the live event is the thing that we cannot reproduce on the stage. No, it's clips.
Show us clips of why we should watch these shows. I mean, that's I joke every time we talk about the Oscars. I always joke about the Oscars present a salute to the movies.
Right.
You know, where they show movie clips and it becomes this 3.5 hour infomercial for why you should go to the movies. Mm-hmm. And I always ding them for that. But there is something to be said for you are a 3 hour and 10 minute infomercial for television shows. We are in a damn golden age of television.
Right.
Show
and,
some TV.
And this was essentially 3.5 hours of television devoted to making me want to turn it off.
Right. Yeah. Show me why I should be watching these shows. I can't possibly be seeing all these shows, right?
Yeah.
So show me why I should be watching them, especially when they win damn awards.
I'm going to stick up for something that was widely dinged today, which is the deliberate throwback to the cheese fests of yesteryear with the interpretive dance about the different
Do
shows.
Do you think that was a deliberate throwback?
Well, was aged smoke Gouda. That was intentional cheese. They called them in the number in the middle of the show, they called them the Emmy Gold Dancers. So instead of Marilyn McCoo and Andy Gibb, we get Nathan Fillion and Sarah Silverman, which is a trade-up, let's agree.
Oh, okay, but I'm not talking about that number. There were two different numbers. The number in the middle of the show mm-hmm. was the one where Neil Patrick Harris came out and he was doing a little bit of patter.
It begins with the most dispiriting words you can ever hear on television.
Well, here we are halfway through the show, and I've been getting lots of tweets asking me why I haven't done a big musical number. First of all, thank you.
Well, there's several of the most dispiriting things you could say. Also, I've been getting lots of tweets.
So there was that number had Sarah Silverman and Nathan Fillion mm-hmm. and some other funny people in it, and I think was in good humor. The other one was interpretive dance in which a group of dancers choreographed by the nominated choreographers did little dances for different nominated shows, which in some cases made all the sense in the world, like people doing the Charleston with Boardwalk Empire or whatever. And in other cases, it was two dudes wearing the Jesse and Walt meth making suits from Breaking Bad doing hip hop dancing
with boxes
because they're Breaking Bad music
because they're breaking Linda.
Yeah, they were breaking.
It was to me that part was. I have nothing against honoring the choreographers. I like choreographers just fine.
Mm-hmm. You know, at some point we should talk about like who won awards and stuff. But before
do we have to,
but before we get to that point, I do want to mention the most thankless job in the history of television, which belonged to poor Shamar Moore.
Thank you. Right?
Who was like like somewhere Brian Dunkelman is like dodged a bullet.
Oh man.
Yeah, so Shamar Moore was backstage.
He was backstage. Like, I'm kicking it backstage with Bob Newhart, which felt like he's there with Bob Newhart standing next to him. So I'm Shamar Moore with an 88-year-old man.
And Bob Newhart looked like he had just grabbed him and he had no idea what was going on.
And I thought they were setting up like a brilliant
bit.
Satirical
right.
bit where Bob Newhart gets to be Bob Newhart fusspot, you know, while Shamar Moore is like gamely trying to toss questions at him. And instead it was just every time poor Shamar Moore, who I think CBS,
keeps him in a cage.
Right, sure.
You know, he was a Young and the Restless actor.
Right.
They just bring him on show after show. And I think maybe they just have a locker that they keep him in.
I really felt for the guy. I mean, it was cringeworthy. And I have never wanted to look away from a guy who looks that hot.
I mean, right?
He's just unbelievably attractive. And yet my eyes said Shamar Moore, but my brain said Shamar Less. Much less.
Boo.
I figured you guys would get it, so I didn't have to actually do it.
But here's the thing. Like, once again, what a waste of time when they were hustling people off the stage without barely having a
minute
to talk.
And running 10 minutes long.
Like, before we talk about awards, though, because
we've
just
what
been
actually happened on the
flailing
awards.
On flailing at this thing, I would like to talk about two small things that I did like. Jim Parsons, who appeared to get actually emotional at his third
Emmy win. He wins every year,
right.
But okay.
And the little bit that Tony Hale was doing behind Julia Louis-Dreyfus when she won for Veep. I thought it was adorable. It was clearly rehearsed.
Yes.
Which they
could afford to do because obviously she was going to win.
Right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, still, if you're talking about an evening in which a whole bunch of rehearsed scripted bits didn't work, that was cute.
I enjoyed Mara Weaver's
See, this is what I mean. Honest, legitimate surprises, Anna Gunn for Breaking Bad, Tony Hale for Veep, The Colbert Report for writing, and for Best Variety Show.
I was very, very pleased, awards-wise, to see The Colbert Report finally unseat The
Daily
Show.
That's a really long. How long is that streak?
The streak is 10 years that The Daily Show won Best Variety, Comedy, such and such. Mm-hmm. And I love The Daily Show. I love Jon Stewart. The Colbert Report has been funnier and more relevant for, I would say, at least 4 years.
And because of its constraints, it's that thing, he's dancing backwards in heels. You know, because of that specific thing that he has to do each and every night, there's arguably more skill.
Well, The Daily Show, as much as I love The Daily Show, to me, Jon Stewart is starting to inch closer to Will McAvoy territory of the kind of Jon Stewart truth teller in ways that Stephen Colbert is just being not only, I think, sharper, but funnier.
Yeah, I agree with you that Jon Stewart does a little more of that. I agree with you that Colbert is funnier, and I think that Colbert more frequently has things that you just wouldn't have thought he would do. That you just things that are just interesting and funny, like that Daft Punk thing.
Oh, my God.
just so many things that are just, he seems to be such a game person that he kind of gets everyone's participation. So I was very happy about that win as well.
Yeah. I was happy that Breaking Bad won because it means that for the entire day, I kept seeing photos of Aaron Paul at the after party. And every one of those photos, he just looks like the happiest dude in the world.
I said this last week, but I just love that kid. I think he's so much fun to watch kind of going through this experience. And I was very happy about Breaking Bad and very happy about Anna Gunn. Because she, what a deserved and long awaited.
And people were saying it's the farewell. It's not the farewell. They're coming back next year because of
this. They will be back next year.
Do you think maybe next year Bryan Cranston could beat Jeff Daniels?
I
like Jeff Daniels fine, but wow. The Newsroom?
I went off of that show long enough ago that I don't pronounce judgment, but he certainly wasn't deserving based on anything from the first season of that show that I saw.
I wasn't thrilled to see Modern Family win comedy again.
I mean, I'm glad that they loosened their grip on the acting categories, which is how you got that Tony Hale win and the Merritt Weaver win.
I was thrilled with the Tony Hale win. I just love him. Sure. I mean, obviously, all that residual Buster goodwill. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Trying to find some silver linings in a three-hour and 10-minute...
The awards themselves were not without silver linings, I don't think. I think the Breaking Bad and the Merritt Weaver and some of those. But boy, that just... It was so leaden. And it was like it started off leaden, and then they started talking about death.
Well, I liked what I did.
And we all laughed.
One thing I did like was in the big Modern Family speech, where it's like, well, I know this is the saddest Emmys ever.
He's a good dude. I think he's a good dude and a funny dude, and I like that show, okay. But I just wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't pick it over a lot of the other stuff, but... Who can say? Well, you should come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH and tell us how you felt about the Emmys and the winners, the losers, the production numbers, and whether Glenn is right and I'm being much too hard on that part where Desi and Walt were dancing. I don't think so. All right, so the other thing we wanted to talk about this week, and I think we did get this as a listener suggestion at one point, the concept of the one-hit wonder. Now, you might think you know what a one-hit wonder is, but today I managed to get into a large fight with friend of the show and my pal Mark Hirsch, music writer, about what a one-hit wonder actually is. And his insistence was it is a person who actually had exactly one hit on the pop, had to be the pop chart.
Yeah.
And he argues top 40 definitely counts as a hit. Anything in the top 75 is pretty clearly, and that number 108 was debatable as to whether that disqualified you from being a one-hit wonder if your other song went to 108. That's what I say.
Crazy talk. I mean, I wanted to make the point, because I've looked at various lists of the greatest one-hit wonders, and they included things like Vanilla Ice for Ice Ice Baby. And I'm sorry, man, Play That Funky Music was a top 10 hit.
That's one of the ones that I had to be... Because I said to Mark, would Vanilla Ice count? And he said, no, because of Play That Funky Music. And that I completely understand. That's two.
And I would even say, like, Aha, you know, who had Take On Me, also had The Sun Always Shines on TV, which was a top 20 hit, and which, when I accidentally push play all on my iPod, is the first thing that comes up. You have Men Without Hats. They had The Safety Dance, but they also had Pop Goes the World, top 20 hit. I feel like top 20.
Yeah.
Negate.
Yeah. Well, here's how this came up, was that Mark and I were talking about the Click Five, a group that had a song called Just the Girl, which actually is on one of the Happy Making Music mixes on Spotify. Look, let's face it. It went to like number 11 or something like that.
Right.
It's their hit. But they had some other song, who remembers, that went to number 108. And Mark was like, oh, that's debatable.
I'm not sure I knew there was a number 108.
That's not a hit. He actually told me, when I told him I was sticking with my conviction on some of these things, he said, so in other words, I hear what you're saying, but I prefer to be wrong. That is not what I'm saying.
Well, you could also make the argument, there's a flip side to all this. For example, how many hits did the Grateful Dead have? One. The Grateful Dead's Touch of Gray in like 1988
right,
or whatever.
Wonder.
I'm pulling that date completely out of my rear end. But that was technically their only hit.
Right.
You certainly have artists who... anybody care to guess how long the Baha Men were around before Who Let the Dogs Out? The Baha Men formed in 1979.
Wow. All right. Wow. Well, okay. So I will say Mark was very helpful in that he gave me an excellent choice for the first one that I wanted to mention, and this was absolutely his pick. If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits, putting on the Ritz. Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes and cutaway coat, perfect fits, putting on the Ritz. Previously done by Fred Astaire.
Taco didn't even get royalties.
Putting on the Ritz by Taco. It's the funniest thing, because I went to give this song to our producer, Lauren McGaughey, and she pointed out to me that the video has blackface in it, which I completely forgot because I'm cool that way. I sent it to our producer, and I was like, I didn't watch the video. Sorry. Anyway, so Taco, to me, is a perfect example, because the song is so forgettable and such a novelty, and nobody knows any other songs by this band. So in addition to the Click Five, their only hit is Just the Girl. I will also present Taco putting on the Ritz.
And here's a crucial distinction between those two. The Click 5 was not...
There are probably a few.
There are several. I don't believe there was any blackface in any Click 5 videos. The Click 5 is not a novelty act.
No.
Right.
And I think when I was going over all the lists of One Hit Wonder, so many of them, your Disco Duck, mm-hmm. your Pac-Man Fever, mm-hmm. so many of them are novelty songs. And yeah. I think there's a little bit of a difference between that... And, you know, a band that nobody ever took seriously. Nobody ever took Taco seriously. But people liked the Click 5.
I liked the
Click
5. You
liked the Click 5. I like the Click 5. Mark Hirsch likes the Click 5. And actually, my pick, I'm just going to jump in here and make my pick. I have talked about how much I love this song on a different NPR podcast. So apologies for those who have heard me talk about how much I love this song. Lauren, hit me. I know. Who can forget Len?
Everyone. Everyone.
Everyone has forgotten Len. Uh-huh. And yet that song is, to me, indisputably great. And it is part of this wave of 90s sort of alt-rock, radio hit, yeah. one-hit wonders, many of which were really good songs.
Yeah.
You have your Primitive Radio Gods standing outside a broken phone booth with money in my hand. You have your New Radicals, You Get What You Give.
That one I remember.
You talk about bands that had other great songs. Harvey sure. Danger.
I was going to say, we've talked before about the tragedy of Harvey Danger, which is that that Flagpole Sitta is their only hit.
Their jock jam.
If you follow that band, they're actually an incredibly sensitive, kind of a feely. I've come about my share. I only want what's fair. Anyone who knows me knows that I'm not greedy like everybody else. I wanna pay my dues. I only want someone to tell me who to make the check out to. They're a very upbeat and yet really sensitive, cool band, Glenn Weldon.
I didn't go the music route. I went to more metaphorical. But if I were to go the music route, this is just off the top of my head. Where would you put Katrina and the Waves?
Ooh.
I do not remember whether she had.
I think
sure
at this point, Walking on Sunshine is the only Katrina and the Waves song that has endured.
That is what I think is a good definition.
To me, it's the penetrance, how widely known it is by most people. Not a chart number.
Right.
That's nerdy.
I do want to jump back in with one other musical choice, which is the other kind of one-hit wonder that you have is the person who has another life. And you sort of mentioned this with Rick Dees and Disco Duck.
Don Johnson.
The person who has another life, and then they decide to do something else. The thing that's amazing about this song is that you just rarely hear this song anymore.
Yep.
That's because it's, I think the word is atrocious.
This is Party All the Time.
Got that.
In case you couldn't tell, Party All the Time. Singing that song was Eddie Murphy, who
huge
unfortunately hit. Had another song in the top 40.
Was it a duet with Michael Jackson? I feel like he popped up.
No, it was called something like... It has like butt in it or
it
something.
Does
like.
Have booty.
Oh yeah, oh you're right, you're
booty.
Right.
No, it's like butt. It's something like no, Boogie in the Butt or something.
Yes,
like that.
Yes, it is Boogie in the Butt. he says plaintively. I thought you were gonna go with either Don Johnson or Bruce Willis.
Yep.
Both
of
whom
had
Tracy Ullman. Tracy Ullman's song
is really good.
Yeah, it is, and her trajectory is a little different.
I can't believe we've gone this long into a discussion of One Hit Wonders and really not gone outside music, because I assumed somebody was going to be like Harper Lee.
Well, Harper Lee,
that's one of mine.
Harper Lee and Margaret Mitchell, sure. I went with the movie realm, obviously. Mm-hmm. Where you have your Brandon Rouths.
I thought you were going to go with Pachelbel's Canon.
It's on the list. It's on the list.
Brandon Routh actually has had a couple. I mean, like nothing as huge as Superman, but he was great in Scott Pilgrim.
Sure, that's fair. But that, I mean, eight people saw that.
What I was going to say is that a hit? Depends on what you mean by it.
It's nerd popular, but it was not a hit. I was going to go with your Mercedes Rules, who, you know, Academy Award nominated Mercedes Rule for The Fisher King.
Mm-hmm.
But she was very famous from Broadway.
A distinguished Broadway actress, but yeah. No one, you know, she's, I think, her highest profile work, aside from, say, The Goat or Who Is Sylvia, which she was in New York, has been like TV movies. She doesn't work on a big pop culture scale.
I get that.
So I'm picking up on what you're saying, Trey, because I also went qualitatively, not quantitatively. So I'll say the two that I didn't do in a very Trey Graham manner, because I've mentioned both of these things before on the show and I wanted to do something new. But
sure.
The two that I already mentioned was Daniel Waters, a screenwriter who wrote a perfect film in 1988 called Heathers. He has had subsequent successes, subsequent hits. Even.
But they're not as good as Heathers.
But they don't have the sensibility. They're not. Mm-hmm. They don't have the specificity. They're not as good. He also did Ford Fairlane and Hudson Hawk, which has its admirers, who are wrong.
Who are not me, yes.
And Batman Returns, which, of course, hugely successful film.
Who is it that I know that loves Hudson Hawk?
It would be Chris Klimek.
Is it Klimek? Yeah.
So, bigger but inferior films. And then, of course, Charles Laughton in 1955 directed the only film he ever directed, Night of the Hunter, mm-hmm. which is this incredible Southern Gothic storytelling overlaid with German Expressionist shadows and camera angles. It is so overwrought and melodramatic and stylish as hell. It's banana pants. It's a little gay, you know, in a coded way. But the one I actually picked, Trey Graham, was Kinka Usher, the director Kinka Usher, known for this, his one and only film.
They've been waiting for this moment.
The city's in peril, Lucille.
All of their lives.
Butch needs his vest back.
Well, it's my vest, too. I bought it for him.
But now that their time has come...
I'm a superhero, too.
What's his power?
Excuse me. They're going to need all the help they can get.
That, of course, is 1999's Mystery Men. A very odd film that I didn't respond to when I saw it back in 1999.
And was not really a hit.
I like that movie, though.
However, it is vibrating on its own frequency. It knows exactly what it is. I didn't think a lot of the jokes landed. It was co-written by Noah Cuthbert, who went on to do Pluto Nash, and Bob Burden, a name you might recognize, Stephen, because he was behind my favorite superhero character of the 80s, The Flaming Carrot.
Ah, yes.
So this film, I didn't respond to it because it's about inept superheroes, which has been done. It also stars Ben Stiller, Janine Garofalo, and Greg Kinnear, because it was the 90s, and that was the law. You needed to put at least one of them in your film.
It's true.
But the thing about it is, the reason I admire it is it has Paul Reubens in the film, and usually Paul Reubens is off doing his own movie. Like in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, he is not in the same film that the other people are. But this director, who did nothing else, his IMDb page is a sliver, managed to get everybody in this cast working in the same way. Again, I didn't stop thinking about it. I have recently gone back to revisit it, and I do enjoy it, but there's something very odd and very singular about it. So that's, I'm calling that a hit. I'm calling that an accomplishment that hasn't been repeated.
I did want to issue a brief defense of one-hit wonders. It's interesting how the notion of being a one-hit wonder is somehow this gigantic pejorative. Mm-hmm. You're just tarred with it, and ha, 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 you're a one-hit wonder. Well, first of all, one is a greater number than zero.
Zero.
Well, seriously, and everybody knows that there are plenty of people who have zero hits who are very talented and good at what they do.
Exactly. And the other thing that I love about them is they are inherently of their time.
That's true.
They'll put you in a very, very specific place to the point where when we've been having these discussions, I've been really quick to be like 1993, mm-hmm. 1986. And I think that's one of the things that is lovely about them is they kind of capture this perfect moment like, oh, there's Cotton Eye Joe by Rednecks. It must be 1995.
For a lot of these songs, weddings wouldn't exist without them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They get a visceral response at weddings because exactly what your point is. Exactly. They recall a specific time.
This captures my youth. And I think that's, you know, for a lot of what makes them enduring.
Well, and it can be very fluky. I mean, you know, if you listen to the Click Five, there's no reason. And I did see them live one time and I did really enjoy them a lot. there's no reason if you listen to them that they couldn't have had more hits.
Right.
They just didn't. And sometimes it does only happen once and you get the lightning in a bottle thing and who knows. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily, I agree with Stephen. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily say anything.
Well, I think the one that I have remaining is proof of that concept, if nothing else. Because, and I'm glad that Glenn brought the German Expressionists to the table. Because
of course you are.
Because Stephen, as Stephen mentioned, Pachelbel was on my list of things that I considered in the classical music realm. Mm-hmm. But in the world of the visual arts, this person was not a German Expressionist. He was a Norwegian Expressionist, but he had a great influence on the German Expressionist.
Is it Taco?
It's Taco. No, that was Falco. Yeah.
Falco. It is Edvard Munch.
Oh, I get that.
Yeah. Right? The painter, of course, of The Scream, which he painted in 1893. That was the Wilhelm screen. Linda has given away my punchline.
I'm sorry.
The Wilhelm screen is, of course, the product of another one-hit wonder, a sound designer whose name was Wilhelm and who sort of cut this iconic scream that is used in almost every action movie produced in Hollywood to this day. That is the Wilhelm scream.
I'm sorry.
But
I just happen to recognize the Wilhelm scream.
Munch. This is why I like you, Linda Holmes. The scream was painted in 1893. And unless you saw the Paris retrospective a couple of years back or the one in MoMA.
And who among us didn't?
In 2006. Or you were otherwise some sort of giant art nerd. The scream is the only thing you know about Edvard Munch. But when he died, they found 20,000 pieces of art in his house.
They were all by other artists. He was an art thief, it turned out.
He was a hoarder.
He's an art hoarder, yes. And they were cats. You laugh. But the scream itself was one of 22 paintings that were part of a major work called The Frieze of Life, F-R-I-E-Z-E, of life, which included other such uplifting titles as Melancholy, Jealousy, Despair, Anxiety, and Death in the Sick Room.
Oh, boy.
Sounds like the Emmys.
Right.
The Yodel.
The Holler.
The Holler.
the Giggle. But The Scream was one of four works. It is truly a pop culture artifact in a way that a very few works of visual art are.
Absolutely.
It's one of four works that were
American
cited
Gothic.
In an essay. Yeah, American Gothic, Mona Star Lisa. I owe a good deal of this information to a very nice article in the Smithsonian Magazine. They're at Smithsonian Mag on Twitter. It's a 2006 article called Edvard Munch, Beyond the Scream. So check him out. There's a slideshow, and you will be delighted to learn that there are at least half a dozen versions of The Scream.
It's probably more fun to check out than the Taco Blackface video. Uh-huh. So that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
I really strained for some reason to find just the right thing. I think the Emmys were kind of a parade of decay and death. Trouble at home and abroad. The Packers lost in heartbreaking fashion.
Yeah.
So I turned to photos on the internet of cats with their faces stuck in bread. Photos of cats with their faces stuck in cardboard cutouts that had comical drawings on them. And the fact that I brought these to the attention of my children, who are now chasing my cats around the house and sticking their faces in things.
Oh, that seems like a good development.
The cats love it. It is my way of punishing them for peeing everywhere.
I was going to say, this will probably help. This will settle them down quite a lot.
Yeah, because what I hear cats like is disorder and chaos. Yeah.
I have actually taken to buying larger loaves of bread so that the cats' heads can fit more cleanly through the hole that you cut into the middle of the piece of bread. If you don't know about breading cats,
it's a thing.
It's a thing. And I realized, you know, sometimes what's making me happy, it allows me to sort of take my own psychic pulse a little bit.
How's it going?
What I discovered is that I'm a sad, sad man.
Just this week, though.
But I will say I'm delighted. We should acknowledge the milestone that our Facebook page, facebook.com/PCHH, has surpassed 20,000 page likes.
Oh, did we?
So
that's awesome.
Is making me happy in addition to watching people stuff their cats' heads through bread.
That's
the saddest thing I've ever said.
Anyway, Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Merrily We Roll Along, the London production directed by Maria Friedman, will be coming to a theater near you on October 23rd at 7 p.m. It's a one-night-only event, supposedly. The trailer for it just dropped today. Merrily We Roll Along, of course, the Stephen Sondheim musical. It is the story of a famous man, a famous composer slash something, who begins the play at the height of his career, and time moves backward in the story, and you learn how he and his friends came to be estranged and how they came to be friends in the first place. It contains this phenomenal song, which is sung here by Bernadette Peters.
And unto
that's Not a Day Goes By, which is from Merrily We Roll Along. Again, the London production directed by Maria Friedman has gotten tremendous reviews in the West End. It will be available at a theater near you again on October 23rd at 7. If you Google for it, you will find links to it.
All right. So Trey is made happy this week by a thing that involves tangentially Bernadette Peters. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
You know, at first, whatever the oral equivalence of glance is, this is going to sound like I'm just naming a bunch of podcasts I like I always do. But if you bear with me, you will see. If you have the perspicacity to bear with me, you will see. At the end, I'm going to pull it back and go real general.
Mm-hmm.
So on this week's edition of Julie Klausner's fantastic podcast, How Was Your Week? She had Lin-Manuel Miranda mm-hmm. on. Lin-Manuel Miranda is a Broadway composer and lyricist who, among many things, including In the Heights, wrote that Tony opener that you talked about earlier in the show
mm-hmm.
and proceeds to get granular with this guy about the many choices that were made during that piece, in writing that piece, how much Neil Patrick Harris brought to the table, how they corralled all the different newsies that were
yeah.
necessary at the time. So it really, like, this is not a thing that's ever going to have, like, general appeal. But
right.
if you have any interest in exactly why that piece was so good and how it came to be, this is a perfect thing for you. Similarly, the notion of a freestyle rap battle between Scott Aukerman, Amy Poehler, Paul F. Tompkins, and Neil Campbell, a name you don't know yet, perhaps, but you will soon because he just nailed it, on an episode of Comedy Bang Bang, Scott Aukerman's podcast this week, was so good. And yet, it's not going to have a wide appeal. It's a thing that mm-hmm. if you have my comic sensibility,
sure.
it's going to tickle your amygdala, but not otherwise, not so much. Similarly, you would have to be a huge, raving superfan of Breaking Bad to want to spend an hour and a half listening to Breaking Bad Insider, in which the writer and the director and the editor and the craft services guy just talk about how the episode that was on the night before was made. It gets so detailed about the choices that they make, editorially, stylistically, technically. One caveat is that it does suffer from commentary syndrome, which is this notion that
right.
Everything's
wonderful.
Great. Everybody's wonderful. We have to really thank the craft services guy. Like, all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It is not insincere, but there's a hell of a lot of it. But if you can power through it, you actually learn something real concrete on a very incredibly detailed level about the show that you perhaps love. So what's making me happy is actually the balkanization of media that would create these kind of little nuggets of information that are out there for you to pore over. I mean, it's, you know, people rail against the balkanization of media. They rail against the fact that we've all lost our, you know, what about the communal experience? Well, I say screw the communal experience, because I will just be over here in my little pillow fort. I will be going over these things that have very specialized interests, and maybe you can come join me in the pillow fort, but there's probably not enough room for you, so maybe you want to stay outside.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I like it, Glenn
That's
Weldon.
That's my point.
I like pictures of cats within bread.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to start by saying that the first thing making me happy this week, real quick, is that my pal, critic Alan Sepinwall, is on the mend. He had an appendectomy, and then, as sometimes happens in the hospital, there was an infection, and and he's talked about all this on Twitter. It's not a secret. And so he had to stay in the hospital substantially longer than expected. He's now been in the hospital for over a week.
Yikes.
With an appendectomy. But he is doing better. He has now written two consecutive Breaking Bad reviews from the hospital and did a podcast with Bill Simmons today from the hospital. Because that's just the kind of, like, menschy dude that Alan is. And I did talk to him today, and he is feeling better. And just continued best wishes, because he's just the nicest dude. So that's my first thing. My second thing is, late last week on Twitter, NPR's own lovely, lovely man, speaking of the best of eggs, the lovely Don Gagne, tweeted
best of eggs.
A link to a video that I had not previously seen of Prince Fielder of the Detroit Tigers running over to catch a foul ball. And Prince Fielder is a big dude.
Big dude, right? Former Milwaukee Brewer.
So Prince Fielder runs over toward the stands to catch a foul ball, doesn't get there in time, runs a little bit farther and conks in, you know, gets up to the stands, and then reaches over and grabs a nacho out of this guy's dish of nachos. And it's just, and then just goes back out on the field. And it's just the funniest, most endearing thing. And then the way the announcers talk about it, where they're like, did he take a nacho? And then they go back and watch the instant replay. And he took that man's nacho. And it's just so...
That's the best use of the instant replay ever.
It's so funny and lovely. And I was so glad to get that little tweet. It's one of those things Twitter's so great for, because I would never have run into it, probably. And then my main thing making me happy this week, I was continuing to finish up work in my new apartment this weekend, getting unpacked. And I was watching, finally, they sent me several months ago, and I feel so guilty, the finally available box set of China Beach, which people waited for years with this breathless anticipation. It is a show that was on the air from 1988 to roughly 91 or 2. There are four seasons, counting one very, very short first season. And it's a drama about nurses, well, nurses and other, mostly women, living on a base during the Vietnam War, where there are some R&R facilities where soldiers come, and then there's also a hospital. So it's one of those shows where, partly because it was unavailable on DVD for so long, it has kind of fallen out of a lot of these conversations about the really good broadcast stuff that was coming along in the late 80s and early 90s and throughout the 90s prior to the explosion of basic and premium cable around 2000. So China Beach, there are definitely times when it feels like the television of the 80s. And I tend to think of China Beach episodes have their best moments in the middle, because at the end, they're often going for kind of a bigger moment than they ought to be going for. And it feels a little bit like TV of the time. But the stuff in the middle, Dana Delaney.
I was going to say, if you only know Dana Delaney from Desperate Housewives, this is the DVD set you want.
Fantastic performance from Dana Delaney and Mark Helgenberger and, Nancy Giles is in this show and is wonderful in it. Little baby tiny Michael Boatman, who later was on Spin City and has done a bunch of other good things. Just really talented cast. It's been really nice to watch something that, you know, we've talked before about how absent, you never get the absence that makes the heart grow fonder. Just like diving into this set finally. Now, the first season is only going to cost $15 on Amazon right now. It's actually coming out from, it's from Time Life, of all things. So the main thing making me happy this week is watching this terrifically awesome show. And I recommend it to anybody who cares about that kind of thing.
Wonderful.
That is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our producer, Lauren Migaki, at L Migaki. That's M-I-G-A-K-I. You can follow our esteemed producer, Emeritus and Music Director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.